You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. North Korea appears ready to accept President Bush's proposal for six-party talks to resolve growing concerns about Pyongyang's nuclear weapons. That's according to the State Department. Spokesman Richard Boucher said that an initial round of three-way talks involving the U.S., North Korea, and China held in Beijing last April apparently will be expanded to include South Korea, Japan, and Russia. Last Sunday, Koreans celebrated the 50th anniversary of their armistice, which brought the Korean War to an end. To commemorate this anniversary, Peace Watch is running a five-part series this week on the current political climate in Korea from our reporters Aaron Glantz and Nak Nguyen, who are currently in Seoul, South Korea. In this fourth in the series, we focus on the state of civil liberties in South Korea. The National Security Law was established in 1948 when relations between the two Koreas were strained. It was set up to stem support for North Korea. For decades, under the law, activists working toward reunification or peace were imprisoned. But now the political climate is changing. Former President Kim Dae-jung's sunshine policy has opened the door to more engagement with the North, which has helped to weaken the national security law. But as NG Khan and Nak Nguyen report, the law is still working to restrict dissidents.
Hundreds of students and parents protested in front of the South Korean Justice Department last week, demanding amnesty for more than 150 student activists who are wanted for violating the country's national security law. The government outlawed the student group Han Chung-yun in 1997. Among the group's goals are promoting unification, independence, and democracy. But the government declared the student activities were benefiting the enemy, North Korea, and so many of the students were thrown in prison. Han Chung-yun is made up of the presidents of universities and colleges throughout South Korea. These student leaders are automatically put on the government's wanted list. To avoid getting arrested, some of the students have chosen to go into hiding for as long as 7 years. Chung Chae-uk is the current president of Han Chung-yun. He's been hiding at Yonsei University in Seoul for 2 years. He says there are 10 students currently seeking shelter at the school, which provides a sanctuary to the students. They live, eat, and sleep on campus and risk arrest if they leave school. South Korea's Justice Department last week removed the names of about half the students who are being sought by authorities, but only if the students agree to questioning by the police about their past activities. But Chung is still wanted by the government. There are 80 officers working full-time looking for him. The officer who catches him would receive a promotion and cash reward.
If I have a schedule outside the school, I need to have a spy operation. Then I need to find out if there are any policemen hiding themselves outside the school. If I'm sure it is clear, then I can go out.
Among the hardships hiding students endure is not being able to see family members. Parents of some of the students at Yonsei University have set up an office in the student union to be near their children. They spend their time working toward amnesty for the students. At a demonstration in front of the Justice Ministry, Kim Nak-hee imagines what life is like for her son, Lee San-la, who is hiding.
He doesn't have a place to live, food to eat, or clothes to wear. He may have to sleep on the frozen ground, and if there is no food and no one gives him food, he may be starving. And even though he may want, he cannot see his family. He cannot make a telephone call freely because the police can trace it. It's not only his problem, but all the students' problem.
We're going to build a new country for the people, parents and students sing outside the Justice Ministry. We are going to demolish the national security law. They say the law is no longer necessary as relations between the two countries are getting friendlier. Kim Sung-kyo is an attorney with Minbun, or Lawyers for a Democratic Society. He provides counsel to some students who have warrants issued by the government for their arrest. He says the national security law conflicts with the country's growing engagement with the North.
The national security law only examines activities that benefit North Korea or not. But what if it benefits South Korea too? For example, the movement to change the armistice to a peace treaty. That benefits North Korea, but it also benefits South Korea. There's also the issue of withdrawing troops from South Korea. That should be allowed in this democratic society, but under the national security law, that's considered benefiting North Korea. So the real problem is, what is the standard to decide what violates the rule?
He says that even though arrests under the law have declined during the past 5 years, students make up 70% of those arrested. Han Chung-yun, President Chung Chae-uk, says the law is being used to restrict student movements.
If the government or businessmen work with North Korea, it is allowed. But if students try to do the same thing, they're punished. The law should be applied to everyone equally, but there's a double standard when it comes to how the law is applied.
Recently, several Han Chung-yun students broke into a U.S. military base and burned the American flag in protest over the presence of U.S. troops in Seoul. Under the national security law, it's illegal to burn the American flag here. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Na Gwen with Eun-ji Kan in Seoul.
Hundreds of people converged in the nation's capital last weekend for an historic four-day series of events commemorating the anniversary of the Korean Armistice and calling for peace and reunification of North and South Korea. In panel discussions, cultural performances, and political rallies, Koreans and their supporters spoke of the region's history of war and the people's desire for a peaceful future. Ha Young Lee and He Young Yoon, both from CAAV, the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence, and the Chinatown Justice Project in New York, described their personal experiences with war, popular resistance, and immigration at Saturday's rally, which attracted some 500 people to the Ellipse in Washington, D.C.
To end World War II, America dropped the atom bomb and the Japanese surrendered. Thus ended 35 years of Japan's colonial rule in Korea.
Just as soon as the Japanese occupying forces pulled out of Korea, Soviet troops marched into northern Korea and American troops moved into the south. They became the new occupying forces.
American airplanes dropped leaflets with General MacArthur's command to all Koreans. Any Korean who harms either Japanese or American personnel will be punished by death. The Americans and the Soviets shook hands to divide up Korea between themselves. Lieutenant Colonel Dean Rusk, later to become Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, was instructed to draw up a dividing line as far north as possible.
Too lazy to find a detailed map of Korea, he spotted a small wall map of the Far East and pointed to the 38th parallel. Thus, a young desk-bound junior officer determined the fate of the Korean people, separated into two camps, 9 million in the north and 21 million in the south. June 25, 1950, Korea enters civil war.
Mothers left children as they fled quickly, taking with them all they could. They thought they would return to take their children. How could they have known they would be separated for 50 years? My mother was 6 years old. She was running home through the rice fields when bombs fell all around her. When she first told me, chills ran down my spine. Did the pilot see her and aim for target practice? June 27, 1953. Armistice, no peace. Young boys just out of college serve their country, guns pointed at each other across barbed wire, waiting for 50 years for the order to shoot in the most heavily militarized zone in the world.
I was born in 1970 into a world of fear. Money could buy McDonald's, baseball gloves, Coca-Cola. They smelled of America. Soldiers marched in riot gear. They smelled of tear gas.
We were taught not to talk to strangers. They could be spies. Report all suspicious activity to the authorities. During air raid drills, we were taught to turn off the lights and cover all windows. Don't let the North Korean enemies see us. 1979, my father left for work and came home after 30 minutes. Someone killed the president. I didn't go to school and watch TV all day. Thousands of grandmothers weeping on the street. My grandmother, in her soft voice, said it was because they couldn't explain what was happening to us. February 1980, I came to America with the thousands who fled, out of fear and with dreams of freedom, but oblivious to the atrocities those we left behind would suffer.
In a memo to the Pentagon, a U.S. military general reported, 30,000 students are rioting in the streets of Gwangju. The military using gas and helicopters with loudspeakers to disperse the crowds and without apparent effect. The situation appears extremely serious. The Americans deployed Korean special forces to squash the pro-democracy opposition movement. Soldiers trained to fight behind the lines the event of a war against North Korea pointed their guns on South Korean civilians and blindly, hysterically fired. Thousands of lives were lost.
Later, when all the dust settles, a U.S. State Department official would say of the whole affair, Koreans killed Koreans. The United States has no moral responsibility for what happened in Gwangju.
In America, everyone was preoccupied with the Iran-Contra and the Soviet threat. We marched single file into a bomb shelter in the school basement and stood in silence until the sirens went off.
We heard nothing about the massacre in Gwangju, where thousands were killed for dreaming about freedom. In America, we heard news about Korea from time to time. Student riots, Seoul Olympics. But life in America preoccupied us most.
Go back, go back, go back to your country. Customers slammed change on the counter and looked us up and down. I survived my father's rage. He said, a color man can't be a man in America. So he beat his wife and children. Then one day, someone set fire to our store. Everything turned into ashes. Go back, go back. Why am I here?
1991, Koreatown burned in LA. Everything burned into ashes. Go back, go back. In America, girls from Korea, Malaysia, Cambodia, Mexico sit hunched back all day, painting nails for $5 tips from American women. They breathe toxins and lose their sense of smell. My mother breathed toxical chemicals for 10 years at a one-hour photo shop, which eventually destroyed her body. When the doctors cut her up, they found cancer cells spreading. Now she has stitch marks across her chest, like barbed wire that cuts across the 38th parallel.
In America, we have a president that stole the elections and wages a war on Afghans and Iraqis, on Arabs and Muslims, on terrorists and communists, and welfare mothers and illegal aliens, and queer people and poor people, brown people and black people, and North Korea axis of evil and the Philippines and Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you and on me. So America, your hatred has made me a freedom fighter. Your greed made me a communist. Your complacency made me a terrorist. Your tyranny made me a revolutionary.
And I dream of the day when Korea will be free, when Iraq will be free, when Palestine will be free, when Chinatown will be free, when my mother will be free, when all INS detainees will be free, and when all of us, hand in hand, will be free.
Korean activists Ha Young Lee and Hae Young Yoon speaking at a rally last weekend in the nation's capital. Thanks to Reem Kathuda and Tom Gomez of Pacifica Station WPFW for production assistance with that piece. The Christmas coup comedy players of Pacifica Station's KPFT of Houston and WBAI of New York specialize in political satire. In this next piece, they offer a look at Bush's response to attacks on U.S. soldiers in Iraq.
There are some who feel like that if they attack us, that we may decide to leave prematurely.
Our war with terrorists in Iraq, Afghanistan, and across the globe continues.
They don't understand what they're talking about if that's the case. Let me finish.
It will not be over anytime soon.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
The president has no compunction about killing his own people.
Attack us.
Or those of another nation.
Bring them on.
The president is someone of total brutality and ruthlessness.
Bring them on. Bring them on. Attack us. Bring them on. Attack. Bring them on. Bring them on.
Clearly, you can't have evidence that quite the contrary. You have what one has to do is and know that there were something like that would be beyond saying that we had, and it indicated that there were I don't know that we've got perfect visibility into that question.
Bring them on.
The president has no compunction about killing his own people or those of another nation.
Bring them on. Bring them on. Quagmires that weren't thus far. And I don't know, but why don't I think it is one? Nor is it perfectly peaceful there? Bring them on.
The president is someone of total brutality and ruthlessness.
Bring them on. Bring them on.
By accepting the risks and sacrifice, our men and women in uniform.
Kill them.
Bring them on.
Capture or kill them.
Bring them on. Bring them on. Attack us.
Capture or kill them.
Bring them on. Attack.
Kill them.
Attack.
Bring them on.
Sacrifice our men and women in uniform.
Kill them.
Bring them on.
The Christmas Coup comedy players of Pacifica Station's KPFT of Houston and WBAI of New York. Finally, tonight, the Bush administration's launching of a preemptive war against Iraq has not only incited activists to take to the streets, but it's served as an inspiration for a variety of artists and musicians to spread the message of peace through more creative means. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian prepared this profile of one such musician, David Budbill, who, along with fellow musicians William Parker and Hamid Drake, recently released an album entitled Songs for a Suffering World.
Shortly after 9/11, William Parker and I put together a piece of poems and music, kind of our response to the events, and that developed over the next year. And then last fall, we went into a studio in New York and with our friend Hamid Drake and laid down the first set of tracks for this album.
May presidents and prime ministers, dictators and despots, may they be peaceful and happy. May they be healthy and strong. May presidents and prime ministers, dictators and despots, may they be free from fear. May they be filled with loving kindness. May we all be peaceful and happy, healthy and strong, free from fear. May we all be filled with loving kindness.
Without food, without shelter, without food. It's words and music responding. I think, it, as the subtitle says, it's a prayer for peace, a protest against war. Trying to respond to the events of the Iraqi war, and even before that, and speaking to the what I think all three of us feel is the unbelievable belligerence and arrogance of America around the world, and trying to contact those fellow souls around the world that are not necessarily Americans or Christians. And there's a lot of kind of interfaith material on this thing with the
Hindu and Buddhist scriptures. And so it's our attempt to sort of make an offering to those who would like to hear. And it's also a protest against that series of emperor poems in the on the album, protest against the arrogance of the current emperor of the United States.
Thousands of years ago, in ancient China, a boy emperor ruled for a while. The imperial court had placed the child on the throne so that he could be a mouthpiece for the imperial court's desires. Coddled from birth, surrounded by servants and sycophants, told by the imperial court that he was the son of heaven, given to believe he had no obligation to anyone but his imperial court, pampered and protected from any notion of what the real world was like, from any idea of what the people had to put up with every day. The emperor stomped and swaggered through the world, telling the people what to do, taking whatever he wanted, robbing from the poor and giving to the rich, and sending his armies out to terrorize whomever he took a notion to despise. The emperor ruled for a long time, and hundreds of thousands of people died, killed by his armies and because of his abuse and neglect. But eventually, after great suffering, the people rose up and crushed the man who called himself the Son of Heaven, and they crushed his imperial court as well. Then some time passed in which the people lived in relative calm, until another emperor, like the one in this story, came along.
I was raised in the Methodist Church in Ohio. I have a graduate degree in theology from Union Theological Seminary in New York. But I've always been, ever since I was a young man, which was some time ago, I've been interested in Taoism and Buddhism, and although I don't think of myself as a Buddhist, other people do. I don't really care. I've been really drawn to the poems of ancient Chinese and Japanese poets and to the religions of especially Taoism and Buddhism. And both William Parker and Hamid Drake are very spiritually oriented musicians. Hamid is a person who, the drummer on the album, is a person who grew up in the African-American Episcopal Methodist Episcopal Church in the United States, but who is also a Sufi and a Buddhist. William is deeply connected to his own sense of spirituality through music and African religions. And so we all come to the approach to words and music with a kind of, I hate to use the word spiritual, but that's what it is, understanding that music is a healing force, or can be. And so we're all kind of on the same wavelength about this kind of thing.
Tomorrow we are bones and ash, the roots of weeds poking through our skulls. But today is our life. Today we want to go for a walk in the sun, play music and sing, sit down and eat, rise up and dance. It's time for life. Time to till the soil and plant a garden. Time to sit in the afternoon and drink tea. Time to make love. Time to visit with friends. It's time for music and dancing. It's not time for war. It's not time for war. It's not time for war and killing. Presidents and prime ministers, despots and dictators, we don't want to fight your war. We want to eat and love and dance. We want to lie down and die in our own good time. Let us die our own natural deaths, old and weazened, crippled and suffering, but let us die our own natural deaths. We don't want to fight your war. Don't let us die from your bullets and bombs.
I just hope that this album might inspire people to give serious consideration to the absolute foolhardiness of the path that we're on as a nation. Every day, this kind of violent approach, the shock and awe approach, the we will overwhelm them approach, is proven to be more and more wrong and counterproductive. I mean, I've never seen a time in human history when Gandhi's attitudes toward achieving political ends are more sensible, and never a time when this idea of overwhelming people with violence has been proven more wrong.
Which must mean, since we will always, always have a suffering world, we must also always, always have a song.
Musician David Budbill spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. You can find out more about his album, Songs for a Suffering World, A Prayer for Peace, A Protest Against War, at his website, davidbudbill.com. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.